Have you ever heard of nephophobia?
What is it?
It's fear of clouds.
Does it mean you can't go outside or you just don't look up?
I think maybe you just carry an umbrella everywhere you go. Welcome to season two of Airspace. We're so glad to be back with a brand new season. I'm Nick Partridge.
And I'm Emily Martin. Matt Shindell is away this episode, but he'll be back for our next one.
Today, we're going to talk about something pilots try really hard to avoid. Cumulonimbus clouds.
Otherwise known as thunderstorms. And you really want to avoid flying through them. You really, really want to avoid ejecting out into them.
We'll revisit one pilot's harrowing tale of doing just that.
We'll also talk to a cloud specialist, Elisa Murillo, to help us understand the science of storms.
A good way to think about it is that all storms are clouds, but not all clouds are storms.
And we'll hear from an expert pilot who navigates around clouds regularly and knows firsthand how serious they can be.
Flying into clouds for pilots that aren't trained is one of the leading causes of accidents, especially in small personal airplanes.
Flying and falling through clouds. That's coming up next on Airspace from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum with support from PRX. Let's start with the story of a guy who, shall we say, had a turbulent experience with a cloud. And not just any cloud, a thundercloud. Nick, you know this story pretty well.
This is the story of William Rankin, who almost drowned in midair. So it was not a dark and stormy night. It was a warm, sunny summer's day. It was July 26th, 1959. Rankin was flying from Massachusetts to South Carolina, and a storm cloud, a big, angry, anvil-shaped cumulonimbus, starts to form ahead of his airplane. So he does what you would normally do and pulls up to try and fly over it.
We've experienced this on a commercial plane, right, where you hit some turbulence, and so the pilot either goes up or down to try and kind of get around it.
Right. It's kind of the normal MO. As he's climbing and as he's passing through 47,000 feet, he hears all of the bad engine noises.
All the things that you don't want to hear,
yeah.
Like, say, in your car, but at 47,000
right.
feet.
And then, to make matters worse, the warning light that says fire.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's gonna need to get out of that airplane, which, if you think back to the episode we did, bailing out, under optimal circumstances, bailing out of an airplane is not easy. So William Rankin, he's north of 47,000 feet. So he comes out of the airplane.
Ejects from his Air Force jet?
Yep. Things to know. He does not have a pressure suit on.
So no pressure suit. We're accustomed to flying almost this high in a commercial jet, but those cabins are pressurized.
Like almost this high, but still 50% lower.
Sure.
Like that it's big. Like he's probably 20,000 feet higher than the top of Mount Everest. And as you may have heard over the years, like it takes weeks to get to the top of Mount Everest so that the altitude doesn't kill you.
So what's that like to be ejecting out of an airplane and you have no compression suit?
Sucks real bad is the scientific term. Instant decompression shock. Terrible, terrible pain. Eyes start bleeding. Nose bleeds. Ears bleed. His stomach distended immediately to the level of like third trimester.
Oh, jeez.
And all of this was because of the pressure difference. It was negative 70 when he got out of the airplane.
Oh, so like instant frostburn?
Frostburn.
Frostbite.
Left glove stayed with the airplane. And so his hand immediately froze, to your point of frost burn. Feels like fire on your face and on your neck and on your exposed hand. And the only blessing that you can look forward to is that all of the parts that feel like they're on fire will be numb very soon.
Great. So this is a rosy picture.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens next?
He's got his parachute on, but it's not open. And he's burning, he's freezing, he's bleeding, and he's headed towards this cloud. The other thing to know is that he's spinning, and he is spinning so fast that the G-forces keep his arms and legs in a spread eagle position, and he cannot move them no matter how hard he tries. He can't reach his oxygen mask.
Oh, he has an oxygen mask.
Mm-hmm.
But he just can't get to it.
Right, can't
Great.
Reach it.
Yep. Okay, yep. So then he falls into the thundercloud?
So he does hit the cloud, and fortunately, he puts his oxygen mask on his face, so he's got 3 to 5 minutes of oxygen.
Okay.
It's designed to get him to a point where his parachute will open. It's on an automatic switch, so it'll happen at about 10,000 feet when he's low enough to breathe. He's already thinking, when I get to the ground, the guys are going to love this. I'm going to be able to say that I came out of my airplane at 45 or 47 or 50,000 feet, and it was terribly painful, but he's already thinking, oh, I'm going to live. It's going to be fun. And then his parachute does open. Unfortunately, it was not sensing a pressure difference because it was at 10,000 feet. It was sensing a pressure difference because he was in a storm cloud.
So the parachute opened way too soon.
The parachute did not open when it was supposed to, that is for sure.
So what caused that chute to open? We asked a meteorology scholar and expert in clouds to help us with that one.
A good way to think about it is that all storms are clouds, but not all clouds are storms.
Meet Elisa Murillo.
So basically, thunderstorms are made up of cumulonimbus clouds. The pressure inside the cloud will be much lower than what it is outside of the cloud. And that also has to do with the precipitation, the water droplets that are in the cloud as well.
So essentially, this sort of zone of lower pressure inside the cloud would sort of make the pressure sensor on his parachute think that they were at a lower altitude than they actually were.
Correct.
He was in a place where the pressure was such that it tripped that switch.
Yes. Where you have a center of low pressure, you have air rushing into that area and then shooting upwards, like into the atmosphere.
These updrafts and downdrafts, how fast do they typically move?
Specifically in storms, that's where you would find the fastest updrafts. You can have updrafts between 10 meters per second to 50 meters per second, which is around 20 miles per hour to a little over 100 miles per hour, which is extremely intense for somebody to be flying through.
Nick, sounds like the updrafts and downdrafts that are happening inside this storm cloud are really important to this story.
Like, the last thing that you want is to hit the ground at full speed. The second to last thing that you may want is to go back up.
When you're going down.
Because that's not solving your problem at
right.
all. Mm-hmm. There's a phenomenon called cloud suck. If you've got any sort of a wing apparatus or anything that'll catch the air, say
or
a
like
parachute.
Or like a parachute.
Like a parachute, hypothetically. He senses that he's moving in the wrong direction.
So he's going up now instead of down.
And from there, a absolutely historic odyssey of pain and suffering ensues.
Wait, more pain and suffering than the decompression and the bleeding and the frostburn?
We have yet to begin.
Excellent. So William Rankin was falling through this thundercloud, and as he was falling, he then gets sucked back up, and then he gets dropped back down again and again. Elisa, what was going on inside that cloud to create this kind of washing machine effect?
Updrafts generally aren't strong enough to be able to push up an entire human. So it was likely a lot of the effects of the parachute being able to loft that up as well, and then him sinking after he was out of the area of the strongest updraft.
He still has his helmet on, which was good because the hail at this level of the thunderstorm has been described like the sound of baseballs hitting the helmet at hundreds of miles per hour?
Likely what he was seeing was either these larger hailstones that had spikes on them, or he was seeing the really, really beginning stages of hail that look like lots of ice shards before it becomes round. So those are kind of the two options that I would envision he could have experienced given his description.
Imagine being literally in the storm cloud.
How's the parachute?
Yeah. So his concern at this point, as he's being battered just black and blue with hail, is I hope nothing goes through the parachute, like shrapnel from this hail, like jagged ice. Parachutes don't generally do great with things like fire and lightning. You know that rule where or you see a flash of lightning and then you count.
Oh, yeah. To find out how close
you see the flash and then you count many seconds until the thunder. So there's no difference between the flash and the boom.
Oh, there's flashing.
There's flashing, yeah. The boom is your entire existence. It's the birth and death of the universe, and more specifically, your imminent demise. And lightning, instead of being these elegant ribbons of electricity that are happening somewhere else, are feet thick and in these blinding blue sheets. And then, because of the light, everything goes dark and you can't see a thing because of how overexposed your eyes are.
Mm.
So now you're burning and frozen, deaf from the thunder and blind from the lightning.
Great.
Continents of lightning.
Continents. Elisa said it was unbelievable that William Rankin wasn't struck.
Yeah, it is absolutely incredible that he was not struck by lightning, because flash rates in cumulonimbus clouds and thunderstorms are incredibly fast. There are two different types of lightning. There are in-cloud lightning and then cloud-to-ground lightning. And so the amount of cloud-to-cloud lightning is significantly higher than the lightning that hits the surface. So, yeah, it's very surprising that, and very lucky for him, that he wasn't harmed by lightning while he was being thrown around in this cloud.
I think what makes this whole story so interesting to me is I generally think of clouds as these pretty static things that maybe only get blown around a little bit by the wind sometimes, but I'm always thinking of like big puffy clouds and like a really nice blue sky.
Yeah.
And yeah, you see the storm clouds, but they're still clouds. They're totally harmless, right?
So there are many different types of clouds.
If he had fallen into any other kind of cloud, would the story have been as dramatic?
Absolutely not. Had it been any other cloud, he would have only experienced the things that he did from ejecting at that altitude. So like the frostbite and the decompression, him hitting hail and other water droplets and lightning and thunder, none of that would have happened had he fallen outside of that cloud or into many other types of clouds.
Are there other kinds of clouds that can form storms?
Absolutely. If we're talking about winter storms, those are generally much more shallow, meaning they don't go as high in the atmosphere. If we're talking about hurricanes, those are also types of storms. Those are made up also of cumulonimbus clouds. And like an overcast day where it's just steady rain all day, kind of Seattle weather, there are particular types of clouds that are not cumulonimbus clouds that do that kind of rain.
Do you ever get like random text messages from your friends and family that are like, what does this cloud mean?
All the time. I get those questions all the time.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Luca Weslow, who describes how pilots train for hundreds of hours just to master clouds. It's been over 59 years since William Rankin saw a thundercloud and flew above it, and then ended up free-falling through a nightmare. Technology and design have both come a long way since then. So we thought it would be useful to talk with somebody who's flying today, in 2019, to find out if anything at all has changed in the way pilots think about clouds. Luca Weslow is a commercial pilot for a regional airliner.
When we first learn how to fly airplanes, we do so almost exclusively by looking outside, flying not dissimilarly to a bird. And as you move on, that's when you learn how to fly as an instrument-rated pilot, which is when we fly in clouds.
By instrument flying, you're really talking about moments when you're flying a plane where you can't actually see anything.
Yes, all that we instrument flying for us means that we're using just the instruments on our panel in the cockpit to help us navigate, deciding whether a cloud is a good cloud or a bad cloud. Am I worried about a thunderstorm maybe in that cloud? Maybe we're worried about ice, and is it the type of ice that our airplane can safely fly in?
So can you talk a little bit about the training you've received on things like identifying weather and clouds in particular?
Accidentally flying into clouds for pilots that aren't trained is one of the leading causes of accidents, especially in small personal airplanes. And that's why we spend 40, 50, 60 hours of training just specifically to learn the basics of cloud flying and then gain hundreds of hours of experience beyond that. As part of my freshman classes, we actually took almost a full year on just meteorology, basics of meteorology, how the sun heats the earth and makes the winds form. We get into what causes different types of clouds, what the different types of clouds are, And as we get more comfortable with it, we move on to how the different types of clouds affect the airplanes that we fly. So that's really the foundation of the training was freshman year of college. And then obviously we get tested on that as we move up from the most basic level of private pilots to what we call commercial pilots and airline transport pilots.
So there's this amazing story about the pilot William Rankin, who ejected from his plane and got caught up in this storm cloud that had loads of terrifying sounding hail. Now, being from the Northeast, I'm really accustomed to frozen water in a lot of different forms, but hail is not one of them. I've only ever really seen hail that's really tiny. None of this like golf ball sized hail. What is it about hail that you're really worried about when you're inside of an airplane?
So when we are driving around in our airplane, we're going, 300 extra miles per hour through the air. So you can take any object that's floating around and add 300 miles per hour to it. Tiny little pieces of ice, they can impact our windshields or our engines or the front of the wings. And just like they dent a car, they would dent the front of the airplane. Although I don't believe there's ever been any serious accident in a passenger airplane related to hail. In a small airplane, it could be pretty devastating, like a little four-passenger airplane, a little propeller plane. And that's why we avoid thunderstorms in the first place.
And what about lightning?
So with lightning, that's probably one of the scariest sounding to a passenger. Oh, I get hit by lightning.
Yes, it sounds very, very scary. Very scary.
And it's probably one of the lesser concerns for us as pilots. Conveniently, the airplane's totally covered in metal skin and light electronically insulated from any static charges that you might accrue while you're flying. So if you do get hit by lightning, which is a thing that happens quite a bit, especially in the summer, the lightning tends to flow around the airplane and continues to the ground, usually without anyone on the airplane or even the pilots being aware that it happened. Sometimes after you land, you might see a little black spot where the actual lightning hit. And if you go down to the back of the airplane, you'll see a little black spot. But that's just where it went in and went out. Just like how they say to be safe in a thunderstorm, you should stay in your car.
Oh, my God. Wait, so would you feel the strike? Not like electrically, like a shock, but I mean, like, would you feel a bump?
I've heard that sometimes you do sort of hear a pop, but oftentimes you have no idea.
So you're telling us that lightning striking the plane shouldn't freak us out?
Absolutely should not.
Oh, my gosh. That's going to take me some time, but I believe you. I trust you.
I'm not worried about it day to day.
So, Nick, Luca makes it pretty clear that all pilots take clouds super seriously, even if they keep it together. Can you now take us back to William Rankin? Because he's still up close and personal with a pretty terrifying thundercloud. And he's being kind of pulled up and down all over the place in this cloud, and he's not having a super great time.
When we last saw our hero, he was battered from the altitude, battered from the cold, the parachute collapsing on his face like a wet blanket, the air so full of rain that he nearly drowns in midair. He does get seasick and throws up several times,
Great. Even
though he's a Marine. Miraculously, though, William Rankin survived this.
Wow.
He does get through the cloud, and he's only a couple of hundred feet above the ground at this point. Still had that helmet on, remember?
Yep.
Which is good because he hit a tree
on the
way down. Yeah. The final indignity of the storm.
It's not funny.
Yep. It's funny because he lived, you know? Like, I guess, you know, if he can talk about how hitting the tree was the final thing.
Was he seen landing on the ground? Was he just found there in a pile of, like, limbs? Like, what? How did he?
No.
I mean,
he had to do a search to find a road, and then people didn't pick him up because he looked so terrifying. Eventually, someone did pick him up, and they didn't take him to a hospital. They took him to a country store.
Did he get to a hospital?
Eventually, but he had to call his own ambulance.
No, like... It's great. Well, I suppose it's the 50s. It's not like he had an iPhone in his pocket.
We have all of these wonderful details because Rankin wrote an autobiography about, well, his life, but really this one 45-minute chunk. It's called The Man Who Rode the Thunder.
Riding thunder sounds like maybe it could be kind of cool, but this experience that William Rankin had doesn't actually sound like a good time.
Yeah, and two things that worked throughout this entire scenario, his helmet and his watch. He bailed out at exactly 6 p.m.
What time was it when he landed on the ground?
Exactly 6:45.
Oh, my gosh. Which has got to be the longest and shortest trip of his life.
Yeah. If we made this episode 45 minutes, it would feel really long. Now imagine you're listening to it in the most terrifying environment imaginable. He was relieved to find out later that it was one of the most severe storms ever on record for the East Coast.
Oh, jeez. Where do you find these stories?
I've heard this story around. I mean, it's pretty outlandish. So people tell it like, you know, like you tell stories that aren't yours. But it is also in a book that I got for Christmas called The Cloud Spotter's Guide that is the science, history, and culture of clouds.
Okay.
It's one of the early things that they use to illustrate that even though clouds are very cheerful, please do not mess with them. That's it for this episode of Airspace. Follow us on Instagram at Airspace Podcast. All of our photos are curated by Emily.
Airspace is produced by Katie Moyer, Jocelyn Frank, and Lizzie Peabody. Mixed by Tarek Fuda. Special thanks to Laura Krantz, Jason Orfanin, Genevieve Sponsler, John Barth, and sound recordists Huggy 13 Ear, Robin Hood 76, Inspector J, Timber, and Alon's 10D.
This episode was supported by PRX and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. More information at sloan.org.
William Rankin totally redefined cloud suck.